From the Christian Research Institute in Charlotte, North Carolina, this is the Bible Answer Man with Hank Hanegraaff. We're on the air because life and truth matter. On today's special edition of the Bible Answer Man broadcast, we present an episode of the Hank Unplugged podcast. Here now is Hank Hanegraaff.
And welcome to another edition of Hank Unplugged. This is the podcast that brings some of the most interesting, informative, inspirational people on the planet directly to you. You get to join in as we have a great conversation today with Dr. Gary Habermas. He is one of those people that I have admired from the time that I became a Christian, quite frankly. He's a distinguished professor and chair of the Department of Philosophy and Theology at Liberty University. He has dedicated his professional life to the examination of the relevant historical, the philosophical, the theological issues surrounding the death and resurrection of Jesus Christ, and his extensive, and I mean extensive, list of publications and debates provides a thorough account of the current state of the issue, including a strong argument for the philosophical possibility of miracles and the historicity of the resurrection of Jesus Christ, as well as the theological and practical implications of the resurrection of Jesus Christ. Dr. Habermas has written many, many books, including The Historical Jesus, Ancient Evidence for the Life of Christ, The Case for the Resurrection of Jesus, and The Risen Jesus and Future Hope. And he has a passion to teach Christians how to present and defend the case for the resurrection. And I'm extraordinarily excited to be talking to Dr. Habermas because this is a man who maybe we would call Mr. Resurrection. He has devoted his life to demonstrating not only that resurrection is a historical reality, but that the resurrection has dramatic implications for how you and I live our lives in the present. Dr. Habermas, great to have you with me.
Well, thank you. I'm glad to be here. And then, boy, oh boy, that was quite the introduction. I remember a friend of mine said one time, when people give you flowery introductions, just remember that introductions are like perfume. You're supposed to sniff it, not drink it. So I just have to remember not to drink or I might get a big head.
You know what? I was just looking the other day. I didn't realize this, that you are older than I am. You were born in 1950, but so was I. But you are 20 days older than I am.
That makes me old and you young.
Exactly.
20 days, so I got that.
I'm making a big deal out of 20 days these days.
All right. Yeah. All right. Well, I guess when it happens to you and you find that out about somebody else, you want to feel young.
Exactly.
So we'll call you the young guy.
Exactly. Well, I appreciate that. How did you get involved in this whole area of apologetics to begin with?
You know, Hank, I get asked that a lot, and it would be real nice. I tell people it would be real nice if I could say, well, I'm a rather altruistic chap, and I just love to help people, and I talk to a lot of people with doubts and blah, 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 and so I found out that the resurrection really helps them. But that's not really the way it went down. Hmm. When I was raised in a German Baptist church, and in my early teen years, I started having some rather intense doubts. And as I think back about it, just an autobiographical comment, they very well could have started because you talked about, you know, applying Christianity to our lives and what difference it makes. The closest person in my life at that time, who was my great-grandmother, she died. Hmm. And I very much think that my doubts could have been an expression of you know, questions like an afterlife and where is she and what can I believe in and how do we know it's true. But at any rate, I got involved in some intense doubt, and Christians came alongside me, including my German Baptist pastor, who was rather a fideist. He just didn't think we needed reasons to believe. He didn't mind people studying them, but he didn't think we should have to get into it that much. And my Christian friends would say things like, well, why don't you study the reliability of the Bible? Or why don't you look at creation? I hear there's a lot of evidence for creation. Or why don't you look at the flood? Or how about New Testament archaeology? And the list goes on and on. And I thanked them, and usually I would get into the topic they suggested just long enough to find out that either there was nothing to it, or there might have been something to it, but not something I could hang my hat on, you know, something that was interesting. And then one day, I was doing some reading, because I started reading incessantly and studying, and I realized that if Jesus was raised from the dead, that event could bear the weight of Christian theology, at least the theology that we call the gospel, because whenever the gospel message is defined in the New Testament, and primarily it's the epistles of Paul and the book of Acts, the preaching in Acts, and always present are the beliefs that Jesus was the Son of God, deity, we say the deity of Christ, and his death and his resurrection. And so I thought, well, wow, if Jesus was raised from the dead, the center of Christianity is true. And you know what's odd is I teach only PhD courses now, PhD students. One of them wrote me a letter just days ago, an email just days ago, PhD student. And he said, I will always remember your sentence in class. He said, you said to me, the resurrection of Jesus is true. Because the resurrection is true, the heart of Christianity is true, and what are you doing about it? He said, I will always remember that sentence. Well, interestingly enough, that's a sentence I started with in my doubts, and I realized it could bear everything, and that launched me into a study of the resurrection strictly to answer my own questions.
And what's really cool about all of this is when you look at Scripture, you see that Paul communicates the reality of the resurrection, saying that if the resurrection is not true, if there is no reality of the resurrection, then our faith is futile, we're still dead in our sins, and then even those who have believed have died in vain. So if Christ has not been raised, there's no sense in going on with this charade, just eat, drink, and be merry, because tomorrow you die.
Which he says too, yeah. Isn't that amazing? It's a center of everything. And let's say it this way. With the resurrection of Jesus, we have everything. Without the resurrection of Jesus, we have nothing. So, yeah, when you say that those two verses, 1 Corinthians 15, 14, and 17, he repeats it. By the way, different Greek word. But the words that he uses, if Christ has not been raised, our faith is vain, and so on. The words in the Greek mean empty, fruitless, void, without foundation. And man, that's not much of a faith.
And you look at comparative religions, there is just nothing on the landscape like Christianity. And so often people have this idea that you're going to find facsimiles of the resurrection in other religions. But in reality, the more you look, the less evidence there is for the historicity of the other religious figures in some cases. But in the main, there's no real sense of even believing that what they are giving their life to or what they have believed to be reality has any validity at all.
That's right. In fact, my TA, who's a PhD candidate, my TA and I just finished two articles on, and one of them is for a journal called the Christian Research Journal. If you're familiar with that.
I'm pretty familiar with that one.
Pretty familiar. One is for them, and another one for another publication. And they both kind of, within a week of each other, asked me to write an article on the uniqueness of Christianity vis-a-vis other religions. And we list about six things that are really different, all of which surround the nature of the gospel. And you are so, so right in that comment. In fact, if I could expand it just a little bit, while all religions have what you might call negative apologetics, you know, you're a loser, you're wrong, that's not correct, no other faith, including Judaism. No other religion has what we would call positive evidences where they can say, my faith is true for these reasons, and really, really give solid reasons. But when I give a lecture in this subject about, you know, what's true about religion, what isn't, I give a list of 10 reasons, and four of them are simply true of religion in general. I mean, for example, intelligent design, you could say you're a Buddhist and you think the universe is designed also. Or you could talk about near-death experiences, and a person could say, yeah, I'm a Hindu and my uncle had a near-death experience. That's for religion in general. But six of the 10 evidences are evidences that Christianity specifically is true. And to my knowledge, other religions don't have this empirical, measurable sort of data that say our faith is true because of this, 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 and so on. So you're exactly right. And the resurrection heads the list for Christians.
Yeah. So take me through sort of a progression on how things have changed in the academy since the time you got your PhD to the present in terms of how people view the resurrection.
Sure. Well, you know what? That's an intriguing question, because oftentimes when I'm lecturing, when I do this general lecture on the resurrection, which I've given something like 2,000 times, I'll talk about differences just like that. And I'll tell them when I was in grad school. Now, you talked about our ages a little while ago. I was finishing my PhD when I was still quite young. I finished my PhD when I was 25 years old. And so I was in grad school. I mean, I was 21, I believe, when I started my MA. And if I were to say in my grad classes in those days, if I were to say to them, hey, you know what? I believe Jesus did miracles. Or, give you a second one, I believe the tomb was empty. Or, I believe Jesus appeared to his followers in bodily form. If I were to say one of those three things, Jesus did miracles, tomb was empty, he appeared bodily, my classmates would probably judge, whether they said so or not, they would judge that they just heard from a guy who's either an evangelical or a conservative Catholic, at least in our university. My master's degree is from a Catholic university. And they might say, oh, yeah, you must be studying for the priesthood or something. Well, only conservatives believe those things. Today, I'll give you a rundown on all three of them. Today, Jesus is a miracle worker. Where is that? Some people, it's been said in books that 100%, and that's not quite true, but some of the research books today say that 100% of scholars believe that Jesus did miracles, at least healing miracles and exorcisms. He either did the ones in the Gospels or things just like them. In other words, you know, maybe instead of feeding 5,000, he fed 3,000. But he did. But that thing happened. You know, so miracles are in today, the miracles of Jesus. Okay, empty tomb. Where are we on that? Empty tomb is held by about 75% of scholars today, whereas when I was in school, you know, it might have been 20%. And lastly, what about the view that Jesus was raised in bodily form, not just kind of a wispy, ghostly sort of form? And that is the majority view today. The majority view is that Jesus appeared and that he appeared bodily. And in a recent survey I did a few years ago, only less than 1 in 4 critical scholars now come up with naturalistic theories to explain the resurrection away. In my head count, I was very unofficial, but in the little head count I did, it was like 23-24% come up with natural theories. They're kind of ignored today. This is kind of a day where the supernatural is in. And so many people say they're Buddhists because, I mean, it's just real popular today, because you can be a Buddhist and not be real conservative, and people don't go, oh, really? And they just go, huh, yep, and go right on. But if you say you're a conservative Christian, you can get screamed at, you know. So, yeah, so the field is changing, to answer your question, and belief in the supernatural is way up. You know, belief, personal belief in miracles, personal belief in afterlife, 70, 80, sometimes 90%.
You sort of alluded to this already, but I think it might be good for people listening in to get just an idea of flavor of why we are so passionately supporting the resurrection of Jesus Christ. And you think about the quintessential text, 1 Corinthians chapter 15, sure, where Paul is saying, what I received, I passed on to you as of first importance, that Christ died for our sins according to the Scriptures, that he was buried, that he was raised on the third day according to the Scriptures. Then he appeared to Peter, to the 12, then to 500, then to James, then to all the apostles. Last of all, he appeared to me as to one abnormally born. The first thing that strikes me is that Paul is receiving something and he's passing on what he received. And it turns out that he's passing along a creedal statement that can be traced all the way back to Messiah's murder. How significant is it that Paul is talking about something that has no time whatsoever for legendary corruption?
Don't go away. In just a few moments, we'll rejoin the conversation. Did you know that without the bodily resurrection of Jesus, there is no Christianity and no hope? As the Apostle Paul wrote, if Christ has not been raised, your faith is worthless and you are still in your sins. But history and archaeology attest to the fact that Jesus did rise from the dead. Don't miss historian Paul Meyer's documentary, The Week That Changed the World. This DVD will give you hard, verifiable facts of history and archaeology on the resurrection. Receive The Week That Changed the World on DVD as our thanks for your gift. Simply call 888-7000-CRI and make a gift to support CRI's life-changing outreaches. 888-7000-CRI or visit equip.org. Equip.org. We'll be back after the break with more of the Hank Unplugged podcast interview on this special edition of the Bible Answer Man. In his book, Union with Christ, Pastor Rankin Wilburn shows that our neglect of union with Christ explains the gaps between our faith and our lives. When the work of Christ for us becomes abstracted from the person of Christ within us, is it any wonder there is a chasm between our beliefs and our experiences? If we're serious about being agents of change for God's kingdom, we must first realize that we cannot be transforming unless we ourselves are being transformed. And that means putting down deep roots into the life-transforming waters of God's Spirit. Be sure to read Union with Christ, The Way to Know and Enjoy God by Rankin Wilborn. Receive your copy by calling 888-7000-CRI and make a gift to support the Christian Research Institute's life-changing outreaches. 888-7000-CRI or just visit online at equip.org. The resurrection is without question the most important event in human history. Why? The resurrection astonishingly did more than miraculously reverse the order of sin and death that plagues humanity. It inaugurated a whole new order of being for us and for the universe. Unfortunately, far too many people, believers and unbelievers alike, fail to grasp the enormous implications of this event. To strengthen your faith and equip you to provide credible answers to questions concerning the death and resurrection of Christ, the Christian Research Institute is offering the documentary film on DVD, The Week That Changed the World, featuring historian Paul Meyer. Receive The Week That Changed the World on DVD as our thanks for your gift. Simply call 888-7000-CRI and make a gift to support CRI's life-changing outreaches. 888-7000-CRI or visit equip.org. Equip.org. Supporting the work of the Christian Research Institute is now as easy as sending a text message. Here's how you can help by texting your gift directly to CRI. To make a one-time gift to help equip fellow believers through the ongoing work of CRI, text TRUTH in all capital letters to 41444. That's TRUTH to 41444. To become a CRI support team member and make a difference on a regular basis, text STANDING in all capital letters to 91999. Again, that is STANDING to 91999. We do what we do here at CRI because life and truth matter. And all of our outreaches are made possible by people like you standing shoulder to shoulder with us to make a difference for now and for eternity. God bless you. On this special edition of the Bible Answer Man broadcast with Hank Hanegraaff, we're bringing you an episode of the Hank Unplugged podcast. There is one very big problem for agnostics and atheists who dismiss the resurrection of Jesus as sheer scientific impossibility and mythological nonsense. The resurrection actually happened. Professor Paul Meyer's DVD, The Week That Changed the World, gives you the hard, verifiable evidence of history and archaeology on the resurrection. Receive The Week That Changed the World on DVD as our thanks for your gift. Simply call 888-7000-CRI and make a gift to support CRI's life-changing outreaches. 888-7000-CRI or visit equip.org. Let's now rejoin Hank Hanegraaff and his guest in the conversation.
Paul is receiving something and he's passing on what he received. And it turns out that he's passing along a creedal statement that can be traced all the way back to Messiah's murder. How significant is it that Paul is talking about something that has no time whatsoever for legendary corruption?
Yeah, it's extremely important. Critics, even those who are Jesus Seminar members. Now, that might not be a phrase that a lot of your listeners know about, but they're the ones that throw the beads in the hat. And if you count the so-called red-letter words of Jesus, they reject, depending on how you count the colors on the beads, they reject between 80 and 90% of Jesus's red-letter words and say he didn't say those things. Well, there are Jesus Seminar scholars. I mean, I'm thinking of one right now who's a very prominent one. And he calls that, as many of them do, he calls that phrase a pre-Pauline utterance. Now, someone could say, well, of course it's pre-Pauline. Paul said he got it from somebody else. But I'm saying something a little bit different. Paul is saying he got it from somebody else, okay. Yep, that's for sure. But pre-Pauline means when Paul was on his way to Damascus and met the risen Jesus, that creed was already in existence. If you call it pre-Pauline, you mean it was there when he was a persecutor. It was there. That means if Paul's conversion is, as it is often dated, 1 to 3 years after the cross, so if you date the cross at 30, some say 33, but if you date the cross at 30, Paul's conversion is 31 to 33. That creed was already there between 30 and that date. And some of the leading critics will put that creed back at about 30 A.D. James D.G. Dunn, who's as influential as any historical Jesus scholar today, says that that creed was already formalized within a few months of the cross. So the way I like to think of it is, we know we're pretty accurate. We don't know about the death of Jesus, but the resurrection happened in spring of that year. If he was raised from the dead, let's say in March, this year it's April 1st, if he was raised from the dead in March or April, and if Jimmy Dunn is right that creed was in existence in a few months, that means it was by the time that year, 30 A.D. ended, that creed already existed. That's how early it was. And the fact that it came down through several people, and there are witnesses, three of the six groups there, was three of the six appearances that Paul lists are to groups. It's very important. Groups don't hallucinate. So, in one sentence, very, very early, very, very significant, and it's real history.
And what's cool about it is when you think through what he said, I mean, I've codified this as the acronym FEET because he gives a four-part argument for the resurrection of Jesus Christ, and maybe we can talk about it a little bit, but he talks about Christ's fatal torment, the empty tomb, the appearances of Christ, and then the transformation of the disciples as a result of the appearances of Jesus Christ. So fatal torment, the fact that Jesus suffered fatal torment, that was in dispute in academic circles at some point in time, but there's hardly anybody that disputes that today.
That's correct. That's correct. The people who would take what used to be called the swoon theory or apparent death theory, there's almost nobody that disputes it. Two of the best-known Jesus Seminar co-founders, John Dominic Crossan and the late Marcus Borg, both said that they take the crucifixion of Jesus utterly for granted, that it is as secure as any fact in the ancient world. That is an amazing comment. They both say it's as sure, and they wouldn't even question it. Bart Ehrman, who's probably the best-known critic in North America today, he lists 15 independent sources for the crucifixion within 100 years of the death of Jesus. What Ehrman is getting at is, in the ancient world, 100 years is a fair amount of time to say that's still early. And so he says, how many sources do we have between 30 AD and 130 AD? And the number is 15. And Paul Meyer, the emeritus professor at Western Michigan University of ancient religion, Paul Meyer says that often in the ancient world, one event, one source is enough to conclude that an event happened, one. And he said two sources in the Greco-Roman world often made an event impregnable. Well, what do we do with 15? 15 independent sources. You say, who put that together again? Some fundamentalist pastor? No, Bart Ehrman, the best-known skeptic in North America. So the evidence is just unending, Hank. It's just fantastic.
It is incredible. But, you know, this is a double-edged sword when you think about it, because you have Islam, who denies that Jesus Christ was crucified and therefore denies that Jesus Christ was resurrected. And this is not just a denial that's made in some obscure hadith, but rather this is a denial that comes from the Quran itself. So it seems to me that if today you are denying that Jesus Christ suffered fatal torment, you are looking the evidence in the face, and despite the evidence, you're just simply saying, I don't care how voluminous, how compelling the evidence is, I don't believe it.
Yeah. And, in the case of the Quranic claim, one of the best-known Muslim debaters in recent time was Ahmed Didat, and he wrote a number of little booklets against Christianity. And one of them is called Crucifixion or Crucifixion, with the second word being ending, F-I-C-T-I-O-N. So the crucifixion would be fiction. And he says in the book, you tell the average Christian that Jesus wasn't crucified, and they say, what's a source? And you list the Quran. He says the Christians are going to say the Quran is not an admissible historical source because it came almost exactly 600 years after the death of Jesus, and historical sources 600 years later are not admissible. Now, this is Didat speaking. And he says in this booklet, he says, those Christians are right. And you have to stop to digest that. Those Christians are right. The Quran is too late. He says, but whenever they say that to me, I do a shift on them and tell them that the Gospels you're trusting have errors in them. And it's okay, so I'm thinking about this argument, and he says he concedes the argument. He said Christians are right. The Quran is 600 years later. It's too late to be an historical source. But your guy's sources has errors. Okay, what's the original question? Did Jesus die on the cross? And what does he say? The Quran is too late to be admissible. So this Muslim scholar says it's a good objection. So now we'd have to answer the there are discrepancies objection. But the point is, he's basically saying we're right about the death of Jesus, that the Quran is too late to make a difference.
And even the sources that are used to modern Muslim scholarship, the sources that they're using, essentially are sources which are denying not only the historical resurrection of Jesus Christ, but they are denying the crucifixion of Jesus Christ. They're denying the whole thing, and they're saying that if, in fact, you believe that Jesus Christ was divine such that he could rise from the dead, then what you are doing in essence is you are committing an unforgivable sin, the unforgivable sin of shirk. You're assigning partners with God.
Yeah, to compare anybody to Allah. Yeah, you know what? I guess a Muslim scholar could say, well, Ahmed Didak was a great Muslim thinker, but he doesn't speak for me. I don't think that. But I'm just saying that's a normal response, that a book that comes 600 years later after the crucifixion is, we wouldn't include that. It will go back to Bart Ehrman. Bart Ehrman counted everything for 100 years, not 600 years. So it would certainly seem that if I have 15 independent sources in the ancient world, ask yourself this, of all the sources in the ancient world that are very, very well known to us, how many of them have 15 or more independent sources? That's amazing. The earliest major, I don't mean, you know, an inscription in a rock, but how many, what's the date for the first major treatment of Alexander the Great's life? Answer, almost 300 years later, about 280. And the best known sources for Alexander, who are Arian and Plutarch, are about 425 to 450 years after Alexander. That's their major sources. And sometimes the comeback is, well, but at least those guys are writing history. The Gospels are writing propaganda. That's sometimes the comeback. In other words, these Alexander texts are not religious. But you know, Plutarch, who's one of the two main names, Plutarch's treatment of the life of Alexander starts like this. He says, it's commonly believed that Alexander was the son of a god and his mother was a virgin. That's how the book opens. And I'm thinking, well, you don't have to call that a religious book, but it sure sounds religious to me. Sounds like he's doing some religious things there too. So, you know, and by the way, somebody might say, oh, wow, I never thought about this. Is that why we got the idea of the virgin birth through Jesus? Well, Plutarch, when he wrote that about Alexander, was writing almost 100 years after the death of Jesus. So now you might say, I'm not saying Plutarch copied that from Christians, but I'm just saying since he's almost 100 years after Christians, who's getting it from whom?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. That's an important argument.
I mean, Paul didn't get it from Plutarch. Plutarch lived and wrote about 120 A.D.
Yeah. So. That's right. You know, so what we can establish with certainty about the resurrection is that Christ suffered fatal torment. If he hadn't suffered fatal torment, we might not be talking about the resurrection of Jesus Christ. But added to that argument is the argument of the empty tomb. Christianity simply cannot survive an identifiable tomb containing the corpse of Christ. So we have real good reason to believe that there was no corpse, the tomb was empty, and because of that, there's great validity for the Christian faith and the belief in the central aspect of the Christian faith, the resurrection.
Right, for sure. You know, sometimes critics, they try to, do an in or out on us, and that's okay. We do that too when we argue, but some of them might say, well, look, according to your own book, the book of Acts, they didn't even start preaching about Jesus for 50 days, and you all call it Pentecost. It took 50 days for them. And they might say, but by that time, if anybody wanted to walk down to the grave to see if Jesus' body was there, they wouldn't be able to identify the body because it would be rotting.
Don't go away. In just a few moments, we'll rejoin the conversation. With an unmatched mastery of scripture and history, Professor Paul Meyer discusses and defends the historicity of the events of Holy Week, which culminated in the death and resurrection of Jesus. Receive The Week That Changed the World on DVD as our thanks for your gift.
Simply call 888-7000-CRI and make a gift to support CRI's life-changing outreaches. 888-7000-CRI or visit equip.org. We'll be back shortly with more of this special edition of the Bible Answer Man broadcast. Supporting the work of the Christian Research Institute is now as easy as sending a text message. Here's how you can help by texting your gift directly to CRI. To make a one-time gift to help equip fellow believers through the ongoing work of CRI, text TRUTH in all capital letters to 41444. That's TRUTH to 41444. To become a CRI support team member and make a difference on a regular basis, text STANDING in all capital letters to 91999. Again, that is STANDING to 91999. We do what we do here at CRI because life and truth matter. And all of our outreaches are made possible by people like you standing shoulder to shoulder with us to make a difference for now and for eternity. God bless you. Why did the authorities need Judas to identify Jesus? How could the people who cheered Jesus on Palm Sunday call for his death just a few days later? Why was Pontius Pilate trying hard to avoid sending Jesus to his death? Is there evidence outside the Bible that these events actually happened? In the documentary film on DVD, The Week That Changed the World, Professor of Ancient History Paul Meyer offers compelling answers to questions concerning the events of Holy Week that culminated in Christ's death and resurrection. Dr. Meyer lays out the hard, verifiable facts of history and archaeology. Receive your copy of The Week That Changed the World on DVD as our thanks for your gift. Simply call 888-7000-CRI. And make a gift to support CRI's life-changing outreaches. 888-7000-CRI or visit equip.org. Equip.org. In his book, Union with Christ, Pastor Rankin Wilburn shows that our neglect of union with Christ explains the gaps between our faith and our lives. When the work of Christ for us becomes abstracted from the person of Christ within us, is it any wonder there is a chasm between our beliefs and our experiences? If we're serious about being agents of change for God's kingdom, we must first realize that we cannot be transforming unless we ourselves are being transformed. And that means putting down deep roots into the life-transforming waters of God's Spirit. Be sure to read Union with Christ, The Way to Know and Enjoy God by Rankin Wilburn. Receive your copy by calling 888-7000-CRI and make a gift to support the Christian Research Institute's life-changing outreaches. 888-7000-CRI or just visit online at equip.org. On this special edition of the Bible Answer Man broadcast with Hank Hanegraaff, we're bringing you an episode of the Hank Unplugged podcast. The famous British apologist G.K. Chesterton once noted, "The true soldier fights not because he hates what is in front of him, but because he loves what is behind him." Because at CRI we love what is behind us, our faith, our families, and our freedoms, we will never retreat quietly from the growing assaults on life and truth. Even when the costs are great, we will stand. To join like-minded friends in making a difference at home and around the globe, and to equip fellow believers to stand their ground courageously, become a member of CRI's support team. Simply call 888-7000-CRI. That's 888-7000-CRI, or visit our website at equip.org. Let's now rejoin Hank Hanegraaff and his guest in the conversation.
If anybody wanted to walk down to the grave to see if Jesus' body was there, they wouldn't be able to identify the body because it would be rotting. Well, two quick comebacks. I have spoken to, this comes from more than one pathologist, you know, who studies and experiments, checks how somebody is murdered. and tries to do the work on that. And the first thing I learned was that bodies don't lose their distinguishing marks in 50 days. And by the way, this man was nailed to a cross. You'd certainly be able to see holes in the feet and the wrists. But this is the main thing. The New Testament did not say the tomb was empty, and yes, there's a body in it, but the body couldn't be recognized. The early Christian teaching is the tomb was empty. If you were going to try to disprove Christianity, and you went down to the tomb, and you found a body and found it unrecognizable, Christianity would be dead from even that. That's my point. If you said, "Oh, here's your guy. Here's your guy right here. His body was in the tomb." Christianity doesn't say there's a guy you can't recognize in the tomb. It says no body is in the tomb. So unless you went to the tomb and found it empty, Christian preaching would be wrong. That's pretty radical. So the empty tomb is strong. But I would say even stronger is the appearances. The appearance tradition is the strongest reason, especially since, like I said, in that very first list of Paul's, it's not Paul's, but he gives it. That first list that goes all the way back to 30 AD, of the three individuals, Peter, James, and then Paul adds his own appearance, and then three groups, the group called the 12, a group called all the apostles, which is usually taken to be larger than the 12, and lastly, the 500 brothers, the brethren, they're called. In the first group, in the first list of six appearances, three of them are to groups. And that's very, very important. You know, a friend of mine, Hank, interviews liberals for, it's one of his passions. He's interviewed hundreds of them. A number of them are Jesus Seminar members. And I was just surprised when I found out that when he said, "Well, why do you believe the appearances are historical?" A number of these quote-unquote liberals said, because of the appearance to the 500. That was their reason. And it comes from this list.
Which is a pretty important argument when you think about it, because Paul is saying that these people are there to be cross-examined if, in fact, this isn't so.
Right. Oh, that's a good point.
I mean, most of them are still alive, though some have fallen asleep.
Yes. And Paul and then right after he gives this creedal text, he says in verse 11, he just got done talking about the other apostles who also saw Jesus. Peter's named, James is named, of course, Paul himself. And there's a group called the 12, so they're all there. Except now Judas has already committed suicide, but Matthias is there, so we have 12. And he says that they all teach the same thing he is. 1 Corinthians 15:11, whether it is I or they, so we preach, and so you believe. Which is an incredible verse, because I think what Paul is saying is, hey, you don't have to believe me. Don't get it from me. Go talk to Peter if you want to. Go talk to Jesus' own brother, James, who didn't believe, when he was at home doing carpentry or whatever he was doing at home. He didn't believe, which is reported in two independent texts, by the way. So go ask James, go ask Peter, go ask one of the 12, or I'll be glad to tell you. But basically what Paul's saying is, no matter who you get it from, you're going to hear the same message. We're all preaching the same message. And that says something about reliability. It says something about eyewitnesses. Now when we find out, too, that I will confess, you can't go through all the 12 apostles and prove that all of them were martyred. We often say that, but you have to start using really late sources to do that. But the ones we're talking about, the big three right there in that list, Paul, James, the brother of Jesus, and Peter, we have first century backup for the martyrdom of all three of them. And critics don't question it. Critics don't question it. But what does it mean if the biggest name martyrs are also the three biggest individuals in this list of appearances? Here's what you have to concede. Even if you think they didn't really see him, you have to concede that they thought they saw him. And if you have the belief, as Paul says in verse 11, go ask them. We're preaching the same message. If you believe that they could only willingly give their life if they believe they really saw Jesus, when you go to make up an alternative theory, you have to make up a theory that allows that they really believed. And that's really difficult.
Yeah, and they were willing to die for the notion that Christ had risen from the dead.
Right. And now you say, well, the comeback today is, well, just look at the history of missions, Buddhist missions, Hindu missions, Muslim missions, Jewish missions, Christian missions. Many people have died for their faith down through the ages. Okay, that's not the point. That's not the same point we're making. If a Christian dies on the mission field today, they're dying for Peter's belief to have seen the risen Jesus. The missionary didn't see the risen Jesus, obviously, but they die for the belief that Peter, James, Paul, 500, saw the risen Jesus. But Peter, James, and Paul, they didn't die for someone else's testimony to have seen Jesus. They died because they saw Jesus. That's how sure they were. You have to come up with a theory that explains their being sure that they saw the risen Jesus. And now, see, that's the force of the "these guys were martyred" argument. It's because the ones who saw Jesus were the ones who were martyred.
Yeah, and there's also this aspect that it's conceivable that you are going to die for what you fervently believe to be true, but it's inconceivable that you're going to die for something that you know to be a lie, and yet they were willing to die. I mean, if the sword is unfurled and you're telling a fib or a lie about something like this, I mean, you're going to say, you know what, I was just kidding. But they were willing to die. They were willing to be tortured in unspeakable ways because they knew that Christ had risen from the dead.
Right. And some of the apostles' own disciples, like Polycarp and Ignatius, we have things they wrote before they were martyred. And they said amazing things like, I hope the animals in the arena, where one of them was taken, I hope they come and get me, and I hope they leave nothing. Eat all my bones, eat all my flesh, because my Lord gave his life for me, and I'm willing to die for him. So come ahead, do your best. And take an epistle like 1 Peter. 1 Peter begins with the author saying, y'all are going through a time of persecution right now. But take hope. Take hope. Why? Who rejoices during persecution? But in 1 Peter 1:3-4, it says, rejoice, because even though you're going through tough times right now, your Lord was raised from the dead. Heaven is secure for you. Nobody can take it from you. So think about that for a while. Meditate on that. I mean, if we can use the example of, say, the Wizard of Oz, the Yellow Brick Road, for Christians, there's an event at the beginning that propels us down the Yellow Brick Road. And the end of the Yellow Brick Road is the Emerald City, which I often wonder, I don't know the history of that book, but I often wonder if Frank Baum, the author, got that idea, you know, from the new heaven and new earth described in Revelation 21 and 22, where about one-third of all the verses have to do with colors, you know, and I think about this beautiful Emerald City. But the point is that the resurrection launched them on their own Christian path to the Emerald City. And so you've got the first epistle of Peter saying, don't worry that you're being persecuted. It's okay. The city has been secured. It can't be taken from you. Nobody can take it from the hand of God. And why do we have this eternal life? Because the resurrection of Jesus secured it, he says. So the force of the resurrection was so fantastic, they urged Christians to hang in there during persecution, because they know there was a real Emerald City. And that's just a powerful, powerful message, but it's not based on on some kind of pie in the sky. It's the message told by the people who willingly went to death because they saw the risen Jesus.
Now, I want to kind of camp out on that for a few moments here, Gary, because I think what's really cool about this is that we've sort of talked about the fatal suffering of Jesus Christ, the fatal torment of Jesus Christ, that he actually was crucified. There is a historical Christ. He was crucified. The tomb was empty. Christ appeared and gave many convincing proofs that he had indeed risen from the dead. But I think the place that we camp out is on this transformation. You have not only the disciples who are transformed from scared and scattered to lions of the faith, but now you have Christians who turn an empire upside down because you mentioned Ignatius of Antioch or Polycarp. They were not afraid of torture and vilification and death because they knew they would rise again. So this was something that was part of their constitution. And I think today we have lost that to a large degree. We're afraid of the culture, but these people weren't afraid of the culture. They transformed the culture because they were willing to die for what they knew to be truth. Christ had died. He had come back to life. They would die. They too would come back to life. And that radically transformed not only people, but a culture, a whole Roman Empire.
It did. And there's back to your comment you made a little while ago. There's nothing like this in other religions. No other founder of a major religion, I mean, I could go down the list, but none of the major names, Buddha, Zoroaster, Muhammad, Moses, none of the founders of major world religions claim to be the Son of God. You already mentioned, too, in Islam, it's the unpardonable sin. None of them claimed that my death is capable of paying for your sins. No other founder said, what you do with me holds the keys to the Emerald City, so to speak. What you do with me determines where you spend eternity. And none of them say, our original disciples saw the risen Buddha too.
Well, we've run out of time for today's special edition of the Bible Answer Man broadcast. To listen to this Hank Unplugged podcast interview in its entirety, go to equip.org, iTunes, or wherever you listen to your favorite podcast. If you'd like to stand shoulder to shoulder with Hank Hanegraaff and the Christian Research Institute in the battle for life and truth, and as our thanks, receive the DVD, The Week That Changed the World, just call our resource consultants now at 888-7000-CRI or go online to equip.org. That's equip.org. You can also write to us at CRI, P.O. Box 8500, Charlotte, North Carolina 28271. The Bible Answer Man broadcast is funded solely by listeners like you. We're on the air because life and truth matter. Supporting the work of the Christian Research Institute is now as easy as sending a text message. Here's how you can help by texting your gift directly to CRI. To make a one-time gift to help equip fellow believers through the ongoing work of CRI, text TRUTH in all capital letters to 41444. That's TRUTH to 41444. To become a CRI support team member and make a difference on a regular basis, text STANDING in all capital letters to 91999. Again, that is STANDING to 91999. We do what we do here at CRI because life and truth matter. And all of our outreaches are made possible by people like you standing shoulder to shoulder with us to make a difference for now and for eternity. God bless you.
The resurrection is without question the most important event in human history. Why? The resurrection astonishingly did more than miraculously reverse the order of sin and death that plagues humanity. It inaugurated a whole new order of being for us and for the universe. Unfortunately, far too many people, believers and unbelievers alike, fail to grasp the enormous implications of this event. to strengthen your faith and equip you to provide credible answers to questions concerning the death and resurrection of Christ, the Christian Research Institute is offering the documentary film on DVD, The Week That Changed the World, featuring historian Paul Meyer. Receive The Week That Changed the World on DVD as our thanks for your gift. Simply call 888-7000-CRI and make a gift to support CRI's life-changing outreaches. 888-7000-CRI or visit equip.org. Equip.org.